Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Tonight, as Donald Trump's former vice president considers talking to the January 6th investigation, his former lawyer testifies before an Atlanta grand jury, and his longtime CFO prepares to plead guilty and turn on the Trump Organization. But despite the president's considerable legal woes, he can't seem to find any qualified attorneys to represent him. Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter Carol Lenning joins us live. And then we go down to Florida, where Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has ordered some new lessons for the start of school this week: revisionist history and Christian nationalism. New Yorker writer and dean of the Columbia Journalism School, Jelani Cobb, will be in the studio to discuss. And President Biden cancels student debt for thousands who were ripped off by a for-profit college chain, promising jobs of the future that never arrived. But we start tonight with mounting investigations into the former president of the United States. After last night's election in Wyoming, Donald Trump appears poised to gain some allies in Congress. But it comes as Trump is quickly losing friends basically everywhere else. Today, Trump's former vice president, Mike Pence, said that he would consider talking to the January 6th committee.
Just to stay on that January 6th, if they were to call you, the committee, to come and testify, talk, would you be agreeable?
Well, I would. If there was an invitation to participate, I would consider it. Any invitation to be directed to me, I would have to reflect on the unique role that I was serving in as vice president. If there's ever any formal invitation rendered to us, we'd give it due consideration.
The former vice president's potential willingness to testify before the January 6th committee comes after its chairman, Benny Thompson, told NBC News last week that depositions continue on an almost daily basis and that investigators spoke to pretty much every senior person in the Trump cabinet. And for the most part, they have all indicated a willingness to talk to the committee. Well, okay now. As more Trump allies signal that willingness, other members of his administration are being subpoenaed by the Department of Justice as part of its own investigation into January 6th. Yesterday, we learned that former White House lawyer Eric Hirschman has reportedly been subpoenaed to testify before the federal grand jury in that investigation. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it is because Eric Hirschman is the guy with the eclectic wall art who gave expletive-laden testimony to the January 6th committee about the White House effort to overturn the election. The New York Times has brand new reporting tonight that the Justice Department has subpoenaed the National Archives for all Trump White House documents that the agency previously turned over to the January 6th committee. According to the Times, the grand jury subpoena, which was issued in May, suggests that the Justice Department has not only been following the committee's lead in pursuing its inquiry, but also that prosecutors believe evidence of a crime may exist in the White House documents the archives turned over to the House panel. That is new tonight. And then there is the other Trump investigation also being conducted by the Justice Department. This one looking into Trump's potential mishandling of classified information at Mar-a-Lago. Tonight, NBC News reports that 9 days after FBI agents recovered classified documents from the former president's Florida home, the FBI filter team is still sifting through those documents to determine which ones are covered by executive privilege and which ones are relevant to its investigation. This comes after we learned that two top Trump White House lawyers, Pat Cipollone and Pat Philbin, the Pats, have been interviewed as part of the DOJ's investigation into Trump's removal of the documents. The Wall Street Journal reports that investigators have also reached out to several other Trump aides who had knowledge of his record-keeping practices, including Trump's White House assistant. And then there is the totally separate Trump investigation being conducted in Fulton County, Georgia. Today, Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, testified for over 6 hours before a special grand jury in that investigation, once Rudy Giuliani managed to get through the door of the Fulton County Courthouse. A federal judge in New Mexico also ordered Trump lawyer John Eastman, who, of course, advocated pressuring the vice president to overturn the results of the election, he has been ordered to testify before the same grand jury by the end of the month. And don't forget about Senator Lindsey Graham, who has also been ordered by a judge to testify before the same grand jury in Fulton County. And finally, is your head spinning yet? Because mine certainly is. There is the criminal investigation here in New York, where tomorrow, Trump's longtime CFO, Alan Weisselberg, is expected to plead guilty to tax fraud and other crimes. And as a condition of that plea, Weisselberg will have to testify as a witness in the case against Trump's business. With this colossus of legal drama, the former president is in desperate need of some good legal help. But as the Washington Post's Carol Lenning reports today, that expert legal help is not easy to find. Here's the headline. Trump is rushing to hire seasoned lawyers, but he keeps hearing no. Quote, former President Donald Trump and close aides have spent the 8 days since the FBI searched his Florida home rushing to assemble a team of respected defense lawyers. But the answer they keep hearing is no. Instead, the president has had to rely on a C-list team, and honestly, that may be kind of generous, a C-list team of lawyers, one that includes a Florida insurance lawyer who's never had a federal case, a past general counsel for a parking garage company, and a former host at far-right One America News Network. The former president of the United States is facing an unprecedented level of scrutiny over his numerous unprecedented actions against American democracy and national security. And most of the legal team he has assembled to defend him looks like they came straight out of a bus stop advertisement. And that is perhaps not being so fair to bus stop litigators. So what does it all mean for the former president and for the future of all these sprawling investigations? Joining us now is Carol Lenning, national reporter for The Washington Post, one of the bylines on this story about the former president's difficulties in getting seasoned lawyers to represent him. Carol, thank you for being here and listening to that roster of legal woes facing President Trump. Let's just start with the lawyers he has assembled. I think just looking at their CVs, the amount of inexperience is fairly staggering. How did this come to pass?
Well, as described to us by sources, Alex, the president, the former president, often is a reactive individual as a client, and he's often trying to plug holes as crises arrive or arise. And in this case, a lot of crises have been brewing and brewing and brewing, including the one that led to the search warrant at his home in Mar-a-Lago for many months. The problem is until the tea kettle started to boil, Donald Trump didn't act. So he's had some lawyers that are actually quite experienced in terms of having been federal prosecutors in the past, but he has quite a few legal advisors as well who have very limited to no experience before the federal bench, and that is a problem for the president. Alan Dershowitz told us for our story that the president, you may remember Alan Dershowitz is a fan of Donald Trump's. He has said the president needs a top flight lawyer stat, and he should have had one for months. Somebody who is nationally known, who has a track record of success, because right now the president is facing legal jeopardy on at least four fronts, as you perfectly summed up at the top of your show. And this one in Mar-a-Lago now is on the front burner, but it's not the only problem that former President Trump faces.
I mean, also, if you're a top flight legal mind, you might also look to see how other fellow top flight legal minds have fared working for Donald Trump. I mean, Ty Cobb, a former lawyer for the president, now tweets about how much he hates Donald Trump. Don McGahn was a star witness for the Mueller investigation. Pat Cipollone and Pat Philbin, they're cooperating with the DOJ's investigation. These are not people who are pledging fealty to Donald Trump, and probably for good reason. I'm sure all of those are data points that act as deterrents for other lawyers who may be considering representing the former president.
Well, absolutely. Well summed. You know, Don McGahn ultimately became a witness for four extraordinary and overwhelming instances of obstruction criminal obstruction by the sitting president of the United States. If he had not been the sitting president, the Department of Justice would have normally indicted a person with the level of evidence that Don McGahn provided about how Donald Trump tried to derail a criminal investigation and avoid embarrassing information coming out about him. In the case of Pat Cipollone, there's really not a lawyer who wasn't a bigger fan of Donald Trump's and wanted to help him achieve his agenda, was proud and honored to become his White House counsel, and has now left with some disgust after January 6th and after watching the president repeatedly in office reject his sound advice that you cannot claim the election was rigged when there is no evidence of it. You cannot seize voting machines and rerun elections, Mr. President, when we don't have any evidence that they should be, and martial law is not warranted in this instance. You know, all of these people tried to give him good counsel. Let's add Bill Barr to the mix. His attorney general repeatedly told him, we've investigated all of this and there's nothing here, sir. All of them found this client unusually difficult and rejecting fact and evidence.
I mean, and it bears mentioning that the team of legal eagles he has assembled at present aren't just, you know, unseasoned lawyers who represented CrossFit and parking garages. You mentioned Kash Patel, former White House aide. He's raising money for a legal offense fund by selling merchandise such as tank tops and beanies emblazoned with the logo K money sign H, maybe cash. I mean, this is a problem, not just, you know, everybody wants a good lawyer and maybe not a lawyer who's merching the hell out of the case. But Trump doesn't have the presidency to protect him anymore. So it's actually meaningful in a way that it hasn't been before, given the fact that he's out on his own. He's a normal guy now, and he needs a good lawyer. I guess I wonder whether in your reporting there is a sense of an adequate sense of alarm emanating from within the confines of Trump land over all this.
Absolutely there is, Alex. It's such a good question. You know, what I heard over and over again was among the adults, and again, it's a limited group, but among the adults around Donald Trump, there is great consternation and fear that he doesn't have the kind of sort of star legal beagle to lead him out of all of these thickets, or at least to give him good advice for how to respond to the Department of Justice. Incredible concern. And that concern, I'm told, has been growing for the last couple of months. Because remember, this Mar-a-Lago search warrant, it has been brewing for months, the fight between the Department of Justice and the Trump team in Mar-a-Lago over turning over all the records to the National Archives, turning over all of the records that, you know, were in question. Have you given us everything back? And lawyers and colleagues of Donald Trump felt that he was essentially taunting the Department of Justice. He was making decisions that ultimately led to this search at his home instead of just turning over the records, which would have been fairly easy to do. I will also say there's a big problem. There are good lawyers working for Donald Trump, but some of them are now potentially compromised. Legal experts that we've spoken to said that lawyers who tried to assert to the Department of Justice on Donald Trump's behalf that he had turned over all the records, that was false. That information turned out to be false. Now those lawyers who made that assertion, made that claim, may end up being witnesses who are conflicted and unable to represent Donald Trump. That's really important and also a big bucket of problems for Donald Trump.
A big bucket of problems. Self-created. It's not like he can't afford a lawyer. I will just say contributions to Trump's PAC topped $1 million at least 2 days after the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago. So he can afford them. We know that. Carol Lenning, Washington Post national reporter. Thank you for making the time to be here tonight.
Thank you, Alex.
Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is on a mission to change what is being taught in his state's public schools.
Obviously, in the classroom, we've battled a lot of ideologies. We're not going to let this state descend into some type of woke dumpster fire.
We will go to Florida, where DeSantis's efforts to dismantle that so-called woke dumpster fire are alarming teachers and parents alike due to lessons that now offer a revisionist history on things like slavery. New Yorker staff writer and dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, Jelani Cobb, joins us live in studio to break it all down. Much more ahead. Please stay with us.
At KPMG, our people make the difference. It's not just something we say, it's what we do. Combining the power of people and technology, we uncover brighter insights, innovate bolder solutions, and create better data-driven outcomes. KPMG. Make the difference.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The governor calls that critical race theory. I call that the black experience in America.
Trying to divide people by skin color absolutely makes no sense.
You think it's not settled that there's systemic racism? You think it's that you need to present both
sides? There's always racism. Okay? There's always going to be people who are like that. But do I think that it's rampant in our schools or in our society? No, I really don't.
In all my years, this is the biggest attack I've seen upon the freedom of the classroom, as I'll call it.
I'm just so scared about the future of public education here in Florida, and I'm scared that it will create this movement across the nation.
I feel like we need to learn that history so we can progress as a country, or else we'd just make the same mistakes.
That is a state of affairs in Florida, where school started this week for most students in public schools, and where in each and every one of those schools, there is a new guy in class. His name is Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida. DeSantis is in his first re-election battle this November, and while he has made a very big impression during his first term running the state, it seems clear that DeSantis's eye is fixed on the White House in 2024, and his path to get there seems to run right through Florida's public school system. Since he took office in 2019, Governor DeSantis has made it a priority to refashion the Florida school system according to right-wing conservative principles, a culture war over textbooks, lesson plans, book fairs, and classroom conversation. You may recall two signal pieces of legislation in particular, courtesy of Governor DeSantis. The so-called Don't Say Gay bill, which restricts the teaching of sexual and gender identity from kindergarten through third grade right now. Its impact on higher grades remains TBD. And the so-called Stop Woke Act, which bans the teaching of any lesson, especially about race and racism, that makes any group of students feel, quote, discomfort, which could be basically anything that suggests that systemic racism is real and that might make students who benefit from it feel guilty. Stop Woke and Don't Say Gay have become national flashpoints, and they have won DeSantis a lot of credibility within the Republican Party. But his work to assert conservative Christian doctrine inside the classroom began well before those notorious pieces of legislation. In fact, DeSantis started this ideological campaign with something seemingly so innocuous and so bipartisan that it raised very few red flags at the time. But what it created and what is arriving in Florida classrooms this week is alarming. In 2019, shortly after taking office, Governor DeSantis called for a complete overhaul of Florida's teaching standards for the subject of civics, which is how Florida students learn about their government and what it is to be an American citizen. Democrats in the legislature, they supported the effort. Maybe they were thinking optimistically, hey now, maybe we'll get some renewed interest in civic responsibility. Maybe young people will vote. But when the Department of Education released the first draft of the new standards for review in 2021, a couple of alarming things jumped out, like how these standards suddenly seem to emphasize religion, particularly Christianity. For example, the new standards for civics teaching required seventh graders to be able to, quote, recognize Judeo-Christian values and their influence on the founding ideals and documents, including that these seventh graders should, quote, recognize the influence of the Ten Commandments on establishing the rule of law in America, which is just not something that is universally acknowledged in this country by any stretch. And along with the Ten Commandments, the new standard called for students to be able to, quote, recognize the influence of the Protestant work ethic on economic freedom and personal responsibility. Now, some of those references were eventually dialed back in the final package, but the ideas behind them, those appear to have survived. The standards won't be fully implemented in classrooms until next year, but the DeSantis administration is already pushing them out to teachers. In 2021, Governor DeSantis announced $106 million to establish something called the Civic Literary Excellence Initiative. This summer, the Florida Department of Education held a series of trainings for public school teachers. Each session was held over the span of 3 days. And teachers, they were paid $700 to attend them, which for Florida public school teachers, who are the third lowest paid teachers in the country, $700 is a pretty tempting sum, especially for teachers who are new to teaching. One of those early career teachers, a Broward County government teacher with 1 year in the classroom under her belt, she went to a training in June. 3 days later, disturbed by what she had witnessed in that room, she blew the whistle on these teacher training sessions, and other teachers started talking too. They noticed that one big theme running through the 3 days of courses was an emphasis on Christianity. One teacher said, quote, "There was a very strong Christian fundamentalist way towards analyzing different quotes and different documents. That was concerning." Another teacher said there was this Christian nationalism philosophy that was just baked into everything that was there. We got a hold of some of the slides they used in those trainings. They tell some of the story of what happened, but not all of it. So we took a trip down to Florida to find out what exactly has been happening to public education under the stewardship of Governor Ron DeSantis. I sat down with Tatiana Album, the teacher who blew the whistle on those civics trainings, and she walked me through what the state of Florida wanted her to teach students about one of the most fundamental principles of our government, the thing that many people believe makes America, America, the separation of church and state. Session purpose, articulate the founders' view of separation of church and state and their view of religious liberty. Church and state, the wall between the two coming down.
Right.
What are we learning here, Tatiana?
So this slide was coupled with a discussion about how the, you know, separation of church and state may not be a wall. It's more like a fence, like a grated fence, they even mentioned. So it was weird. This was definitely when, you know, the flags were going off in my mind, where they were immediately kind of saying, no, there wasn't really this separation of church and state, which when you look at history and you kind of know, maybe that's, you know, somewhat true, but it's definitely more complex and nuanced than the way they were presenting it. So lots of red flags are going off.
Yeah. I mean, also, it sounds like they're advocating for a more porous separation between church and state. They're not only saying it was much more fluid,
right,
the relationship between church and state in the era of the founding fathers, but that's the way American society should be structured today.
Yeah.
Misconception. The founders desired strict separation of church and state, and the founders only wanted to protect freedom of worship.
Yeah, so this kind of misconception thing followed us throughout the entirety of all of the sessions. They would kind of hone in on, these are things you might know to be true, but they're a misconception. And so this was a big one for this workshop, where they legitimately said to us, the founders didn't want this strict separation. They wanted religion to influence people's values.
And specifically Christian religion.
Yes.
Because there's a long windup about how it's about Christian tenets. Mm-hmm. And that's what the founders intended. And so when they talk about this church, they're really talking about the Christian church.
Right.
And this is kind of, this is the end thesis of this whole presentation, or this is the end conclusion that they want you to come away with.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't really feel like, this doesn't feel like a training slide. This feels like, to borrow a phrase from the governor, indoctrination?
It can. It's definitely of concern. It doesn't feel like any sort of other training I've been to.
And our other teachers, I would assume there are other teachers who are maybe not Christians in the audience at the, like...
Yes.
And what are they saying?
They were really concerned. You know, a lot of the teachers I knew that were there, especially those that didn't grow up in a Christian household, they were very concerned and very worried about what was happening, especially those with a lot of tenure in the field.
And nobody could raise their hands and question this?
No. If you asked a question, they used my favorite teacher strategy, which is essentially to say, that's wonderful, great, you know, great topic of discussion. We're going to come back to that. And then never come back to it, kind of hoping that they'll forget that they raised those questions.
Then there is what the trainings had to say about how the courts should interpret the Constitution. In the real world, there is an ongoing debate between two fundamentally oppositional methods of interpretation. On the one side, there is originalism, the belief that courts should interpret the Constitution based on what the founding fathers believed when they wrote it way back in the 18th century. On the other side, the idea that the Constitution is a document whose interpretation evolves throughout the years as American society itself changes. But according to Tatiana, our teacher who sat through these trainings, the state of Florida appears to want teachers to think there is really only one correct view. I'll let you guess which one. Oh, yeah, this is interesting. So, I mean, tell me what you see in this slide.
Yeah, so something they did here was they kind of brought up how the Supreme Court is the reason that we have the separation of church and state, not necessarily the Constitution. And so they talked about how through these cases and others, the Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution to mean this strong separation of church and state. However, through originalism, that might not be what the Constitution was saying. And there was a strong focus on originalism in terms of kind of understanding the Constitution.
And originalism is seen as the right way to interpret the Constitution?
By way of what we were taught at this training, yes.
Right. So this suggests that the Supreme Court is going against the founders' original vision in Engel Vitale, which is the ending of school prayer. Mm-hmm. That's seen as maybe a bad development, moving away from the founding principles of America.
Mm-hmm. There's a slide somewhere in here where he goes to talk about originalism.
Yes,
interpreting.
Yes, it's this one. Interpreting the Constitution. And who's that?
Scalia, Justice Scalia, mm-hmm. Who is probably the most notorious in the modern Supreme Court for being an originalist.
Yeah.
And kind of the more conservative court. Here they only mention originalism. There's no mention of any other justices in this slide. Just him and just originalism, which I think is a disservice, you know? I think that if we're going to talk about it, we have to bring up all the different sides. We have to make sure we're including all the ways that people on our Supreme Court currently are interpreting this
document. The Constitution, yeah.
So
the only way you're taught
is originalism.
Originalism, picture of Antonin Scalia.
Right.
As if, like, it's this guy, this is how we interpret the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, this is as explicit as it gets.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Especially in this moment in America when we're looking at the legacy of Scalia and what originalism is doing to American society. That legacy, as enacted by the current 6-3 conservative court, obviously includes the overturning of Roe versus Wade, as well as the signal sent out by diehard originalist Justice Clarence Thomas that the rights to same-sex marriage and contraception, well, those should be reconsidered as well. That viewpoint is what Florida appears to be emphasizing when it comes to teaching public school students about their government. And wait till you hear what the state of Florida wants civics teachers to tell their students about slavery. We will get to that, plus reaction from one of America's most prominent voices on history, race, and politics, coming up next.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price. People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So, down in Florida, there are public school teachers alarmed about how the state wants them to teach civics to their students. In Republican Governor Ron DeSantis's version of American history and governance, church and state, not so separate, and the Constitution should be interpreted through the lens of originalism, that idea that everything the founding fathers believed in 1787, a long time ago, should take precedence over everything we might have learned since then. Which brings us to the topic of slavery. When I sat down with Florida high school teacher Tatiana Album just before the school year began, she walked me through the official state education department training on the subject of slavery. The only thing I can find in this slide, in this entire presentation about enslaved people, it's one slide, and it says less than 4% of slavery in the Western Hemisphere was in colonial America. The number of enslaved people increased in America through birth. What is happening here in the slide?
Yeah, so this is a map kind of showing how the transatlantic slave trade brought enslaved people to both of the Americas. There's a heavy emphasis that those people were brought to South America.
It's a much bigger era.
Right. And where we're at in North America, you know, our colonies are a very small sliver. And there was this heavy emphasis that most of our enslaved people were born here, almost to say it was less bad.
To enslave children.
Right. Right.
For generations.
To say they were born here, we didn't steal them and bring them on a boat, is kind of what it felt like.
Sort of making a difference between slaves born in the United States and those born in Africa, and suggesting somehow that slave life, that our moral debt is less because they were born into slavery as opposed to snatched from their homes.
Yes, that's definitely how I felt they were portraying this information.
And also that less than 4% of slavery in the Western Hemisphere was in colonial America. Is that to minimize the number of slaves that were here, which still numbered in the millions?
I believe so.
This slide says 2/3 of the founders held slaves. Even those that held slaves did not defend the institution of slavery. In November 1789, Benjamin Franklin described slavery as an atrocious debasement of human nature. Did they give you the source of the 2/3 of the founders?
They did not.
Who didn't even approve of slavery?
Yeah, they did not. Which was odd because there was this heavy focus on primary sources. And so to be given the information without the source, how can I take that back? Other than in my head, you know, how can I take that back to my students in a tangible way if I'm supposed to be relaying this information to them?
And then this is a slide you were talking about. George Washington saying, it being among my first wishes to see some plan adopted by which slavery in this country may be abolished by law, the abolition of domestic slavery is the great object of desire in those colonies where it was unhappily introduced in their infant state.
Right.
So what's happening here?
Well, these are two men that, you know, are known to be slave owners. You know, Thomas Jefferson and the people he enslaved, it's notorious. You know, it's a huge topic of discussion. So it's really interesting to see them position these two specific figures with quotes that aren't sourced, saying they opposed slavery, knowing
they owned slaves.
They owned slaves.
And at least one of them raped a slave.
Right.
But this seems to be the framing here, which is that slave owning in America wasn't as bad as it was elsewhere. The slaves that were owned were born into slavery.
Right.
And the people who owned them did so reluctantly.
Right.
My next guest is the person to talk about The Teaching of History and Race in America. He has been a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, providing analysis on everything from politics to policing. During his time at The New Yorker, he has also co-edited The Matter of Black Lives, a collection of the magazine's most groundbreaking pieces on black history and culture, featuring the works of renowned writers like James Baldwin and Toni Morrison. He has also authored numerous books, reported for a Peabody Award-winning documentary series. Oh, and he has also recently been named the Dean of the Columbia School of Journalism. Joining us now is the great Jelani Cobb. Thank you, Professor, for joining me.
Thank you.
So there is a lot to talk about.
There's a lot.
I want to start with that slide that seems to minimize America's role in the transatlantic slave and this notion that descent-based slavery was somehow perhaps better or less morally egregious than the initial slave boats that brought slaves over to the New World, if you will. Sociologist and law professor Dorothy Roberts explains what descent-based slavery actually meant in the Americas.
The short word is breeding.
Yes.
But breeding human beings like livestock.
Yes, and I'll read a quote from her book, right? So Virginia decides that enslaved black women give birth to enslavable children, even if those children are white. And she writes, that law allowed white men to profit from their sexual assaults on black women. Freed from the worry that their mixed-race offspring had any legal claim to freedom, white men could rape enslaved women with total impunity, maintaining their domination while increasing their wealth. Their control over black women's bodies was key to creating a permanent labor supply.
That's right.
That reality has no place in the civics training. What does this mean? Practically speaking.
I mean, practically speaking, it is a mechanism by which lies can be given the cloak of truth. And so if we want to go back to that document about there only being 4% of the people brought in transatlantic slave trade to the North American colonies, that's technically true. What they don't talk about is the fact that the British were late to the transatlantic slave trade. And so when we talk about 1619 and the 1619 project, that's more than a century after people, particularly the Spanish and the Portuguese, had been bringing enslaved people to Brazil, had been bringing them to the Caribbean, had been bringing them throughout South America. That's why there were fewer. And so when you get to the other part about the descent-based slavery versus trafficking and kidnapping people, that is motivated by the small thing called the Haitian Revolution, which sent shockwaves throughout the slaveholding world, where Haiti, this island, which was overwhelmingly populated by enslaved black people, launched a revolution and overthrew their French overseers. And this terrified slaveholders throughout the West. And so you began to see a push to say that there needed to be an abolition, not of slavery, but specifically an abolition of the transatlantic slave trade.
Yes.
Because places like South Carolina already had a majority black population. There were more black people in South Carolina than there were white people in South Carolina. This made people paranoid. And so they ended the transatlantic slave trade and then continued to keep people enslaved and through the process of reproduction. Production, which led to people being bred like livestock, as I said earlier. And so they are in the using a cloak of humanity to disguise utter inhumanity.
I wonder, you know, when you look at these moments when you have the sort of white patriarchs offering a revisionist history, lost cause, you know, at the after the Civil War. And again, this sort of revisionist history and white apologia for like white enslavement happens again in the civil rights era when we feel like progress is being made. Do you think that's what's happening now? That the DeSantises of the world, that the, you know, organizations that are working to implement this kind of teaching in schools are doing so because they feel like progress is on the doorstep?
Absolutely. This is the old dictum that he who controls the past controls the present. He who controls the present controls the future. It's kind of very kind of gender skewed analysis of that. But still, the battle over the past is always about the present. And it's about rationalizing a particular state of affairs that are, that we see in the world right now. And so if you can diminish the claim of what racism and white supremacy have done in the society, you automatically and implicitly diminish the moral claim that people who are the descendants of those groups have in this country right now. And so that's what the ballgame is right now. And also, if you can muddy the waters around how difficult it has been for people to achieve citizenship, you can do things that make it more difficult for them to gain access to the vote. And so all of these things are about rationalizing present policies.
And we are going to talk to you more about all of this. Jelani Cobb, please stay with us. We are going to talk about Christian nationalism, right-wing politics, and whether Ron DeSantis would like to teleport the country back to 1787. Stay with us.
Obviously, in the classroom, we've battled a lot of ideologies. But what I've said is that the state of Florida is the state, is the place where woke goes to die. We are not going to let this state. We're not going to let this state descend into some type of woke dumpster fire.
That was Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis apparently trying to reframe his civics education initiative in Florida as a moral battle. There will be no woke dumpster fire in Ron DeSantis's Florida. Put it on a license plate. Of course, what the governor is doing here is drawing a line between alleged woke leftist values and his state's American, which is state Christian, virtues and values. It is a theme that comes up repeatedly in the state's civics trainings for educators. Back with us is Jelani Cobb, dean of the Columbia Journalism School. Jelani, what is the utility of overlaying this moral sort of moral instruction over what is a sort of cultural battle that Governor DeSantis would like to have?
So, I mean, generally speaking, if you're talking to the public, people don't want nuance. They want stark lines. They want to be told, to be illustrated that the distinctions are absolutely clear and unerring. Mm-hmm. And so by framing this as woke, and also kind of woke has become a kind of drinking game.
Yeah.
You know, like just toss that word out as many times as you can. And by framing it as a metaphor for everything that you find contemptible, you're able to make the case implicitly for what it is that you're trying to do. That these people are unchristian, that they are immoral, that they are the opposite of you, and in fact that you should be afraid of them in some way, shape, or form.
I mean, the Christian, many teachers said to the press, to us, that the Christian nationalism thread flowed throughout that. And it seems to be a really convenient tool from which you can, you know, there are a number of different, it's an arsenal that is a rich arsenal, if you will, for a number of convenient theories.
Well, it's cynical in a particular way because in trying to break down the wall between church and state, it's not an attempt to break down the wall between synagogue and state. It's not an attempt to break down the wall between mosque and state. It's a very specific attempt to reframe the nation itself as a kind of default Christian state.
Yes.
And you should be upfront about that. This is not talking about kind of freedom of religion, but the primacy of one specific religious doctrine.
Did it surprise you that they were so explicit in their civics trainings about originalism and that literally it's a picture of Antonin Scalia? I mean, it wasn't even subtle to me, but I wonder if it surprised you at all.
It's not surprising because we saw this kind of assault begin, you know, even in the kind of middle of the Trump years, where people began trying to frame any kind of the anti-racist trainings that people were doing in the Department of Justice and various institutions that, you know, government institutions, to try to frame them as ideological indoctrination.
Yeah.
And that created a rationale to do the opposite, a kind of counter indoctrination. And so it was almost always, especially the kind of manifold lies around what critical race theory is.
Mm-hmm.
It was opening the door for exactly this kind of thing.
We have so much more to talk to you about on this. We're going to have more from this this trip we took to Florida and learned a lot. I am so appreciative of your time and thoughts and wisdom on all of this. Jelani Cobb, dean of the Columbia Journalism School, thank you for your time tonight. And good luck in the school year ahead. It's going to be a wild ride. We'll be right back. So we ran out of time here tonight, but we will be back again tomorrow to take another crack at it.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.